to another episode of The Space Show Show. I am your host, Lieutenant Commander Rebecca Frost, joined by Admiral Kerry Jackson.
Oh, hi.
Commander Robert Neal and Commodore Tolok, parentheses, not a Romulan spy.
Nope. Commodore Tolok, not a spy. Not a spy.
If you are watching along at home.
This is my neutral zone.
If you're watching along at home, you'll notice Robert's up top because he... made a complaint about all the bald men being on the bottom. So Robert's now joining me up top on the bridge.
It's not the battle bridge anymore. This is spacious and roomy and light and airy.
There's carpet. Today we are continuing on in season 3 of The Next Generation, which include these episodes: Booby Trap, The Enemy, The Price, The Vengeance Factor, and The Defector. Kind of a missed opportunity to call it the booby trap because everything else is preceded by the word the. Yeah.
Well, let's us call it that.
The booby trap.
The booby trap.
The thousand-year-old booby. Let's talk about the booby trap. The Enterprise triggers an ancient yet effective trap left by an extinct race with a perfectly preserved derelict ship serving as cheese for Picard. What an interesting choice of words. So the episode opens with Geordi. I don't know if you guys are on TikTok, but there's been a TikTok going around recently of point of view, your friend's about to ruin your friendship. And it's this guy who's friends with a girl, and it's very much like, oh, he's about to tell her that he likes her. And if you're the female in that position, it's the most awkward position you can ever be in. Anyway, that's what Geordi's doing here. Geordi has spent days working on a holodeck program to take Christy on a date in the holodeck.
Mm-hmm.
He has fun. They are on a beach. They have fun tropical drinks. There's a bard playing a guitar of some sort at them. And sweet Geordi tries to make a move on her. And she goes, oh, no, thank you. Actually, I should probably get back to work. And... poor Geordi just striking out. So of course he goes to Guinan for wise Guinan advice.
Of course.
And she says that maybe he is trying too hard. And I would have to agree. I don't think anybody should spend multiple days creating a holodeck program trying to. Yeah.
Especially if all you came up with was a bard and a beach.
Yeah, really. After days, that's the best you
bard,
could do.
Beach, and beverages. He got the three Bs.
He got the three Bs.
Yeah. I bet he could have bought that program off of eBay or something.
Wait till you meet Lieutenant Broccoli, Rebecca. See what a guy can do with a holodeck program in 2 days.
Yeah.
I'm also so surprised. I mean, I'm sure the holodeck has this, and Geordi was just trying to be original, but just like a whole series of first date locales and activities.
Just borrow Picard's French restaurant one. I love that one.
But nothing ever goes right at that restaurant. I mean, come
on. That's true. Yeah.
Do you want to go play what's the detective's name?
Dixon Hill.
Do you want to go play Dixon Hill? We can't play Sherlock because that's reserved only for my friend Data.
That's right.
So meanwhile, the Enterprise encounters a rare antique Promelian starship from an extinct culture from over 1,000 years ago, and it's just floating around in an asteroid field. There was a battle between the Menthars and the Promelians in which both sides fought to extinction. The Enterprise becomes trapped by the same energy-draining booby traps that killed the other ship's crew. Picard is fascinated by the ancient battlecruiser and believes that it belongs in a museum, and when they are putting together the away team, Picard, me first, because the anthropologist in him is just screaming to go check out this old ship.
Told you it wasn't a throwaway. That's just gonna come back forever.
And I liked how Riker was like, now, I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, and as Riker should, because he's like, you are the captain. You shouldn't be going on away missions because I want to go on the away mission. And both of us can't go on the away mission. So Picard, because he's captain, gets to go. So Picard, Worf, and Data beam over to the other ship and find the dead crew. They find a recorded message from the ship's captain that the crew behaved courageously. Picard believes that the captain was referring to the battle with the Menthars. The away team returns to the Enterprise, and Picard is jazzed. And it is so fun to see the look on everybody else's face because he is like, that was awesome. And Deanna is like, it is exciting to see you like this side of your personality, because we don't get to see it that often. And it was nice that she pointed out, and Riker's got his coy look that he always has. But as soon as they beam back to the Enterprise, trouble starts. They lose warp capabilities. They can't get away. The power drain on the Enterprise keeps increasing. There's also a radiation burst, and the shield will only hold for 3 hours. Picard realizes that, this is probably the booby trap that killed the Promillion ship as well. Mm-hmm. Their sensors aren't working. And Riker decides to return to the Promillion ship because he wanted to in the first place. And he thinks they had identified their enemy but didn't know how to deal with it. Riker and Data find some more video logs in which the ship's captain says that the asteroid belt has acetone assimilators, which are primitive generators all over them, and these devices drain energy from ships and convert it into radiation, and they were perhaps installed by the Menthars to trap unsuspecting ships that flew in. Picard tries to phaser these generators, but it only makes them stronger and drains their energy even further. Geordi, having now spent days working on a date program, needs to refocus and is tasked with increasing the output of warp engines for longer periods. Yeah, once the shields fail, the Enterprise will only have 30 minutes of radiation exposure before everybody dies. Geordi figures that the counterforce from the asteroid belt is increasing. Science. He's running simulations of the Enterprise's engine abilities on the holodeck. And
like you do.
And while he's doing this, he puts together, the person who created this whole thing that he's working on is named Dr. Leah Brams, and mm-hmm. he is working with her data within the holodeck to come up with a solution. And while he's at it, he thinks, I like the way this fake robot lady talks.
She flirts with me because I programmed her to.
She purdy.
Geordi also probably thinks strippers like him too. Like,
yeah,
let's
exactly.
be honest.
No, man, she's into me. She's totally into me.
You know, I do love this episode though, because this comes back all the way in Picard season 3, where he's like, hey, look. I hate what you guys did to Geordi in season 3, because he's not that guy. He's not the guy that has to build holodeck dates. He's not that awkward. Mm-hmm. He could be awkward, but like this whole season is him bumbling around on the holodeck and being, frankly, an idiot. And he's not that awkward.
He's right? socially, he's socially and romantically a little stunted. And we totally see that here. And this comes back to bite him in the ass in like another season or two, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But
you get your repercussions, Rebecca.
But I think that we need to have this Geordi to get to the Geordi that we see by the end of Picard season 3.
Yeah,
sure. Who but that's why us? He insisted on being married with children, because he's like, we need to show that Geordi wasn't a complete and total weeb.
Yeah, who among us though wasn't a total dweeb in our earlier years, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, me. Not me.
Well, of course not you. Sorry, of course
I've
not
always
you.
Been, you know,
race Bannon.
Yeah. So, using. So, Leah Bram, she's the ship's engine designer. And so he asks the holodeck asks the computer to compile all of the known information about her that exists and to mm-hmm. compile a composite of her that he can physically work with. And they have a cute tete-a-tete, and I have to wonder if the holodeck knows to anticipate this kind of stuff and has, you know, what Data does not have, as we learn later on, intuition, right?
Well,
and
I'm sure that the computer learned from Riker that it needs certain intuition.
That the disinfection protocols afterwards.
Yes.
And together they come up with a solution, but it's not ideal because it ultimately results in they need to relinquish power to the computer to get them out of this. And Picard, you can see he's like, ooh, I don't know. But also at the same time, the thing I love about Star Trek and Star Trek captains is they trust their crew because they're not stupid, right? Mm-hmm. These people are on the ship for a reason because they're smart and they know what's up. And so he goes, okay. So Geordi theorizes, you know, this way to get out. And So what they have to do is they have to fire a short burst of impulse engine to gain some velocity and then shut down all systems, including the computer, and navigate out of the asteroid field using thrusters. So the computer will get them to where they need to be, but then they're on their own and need to pilot it themselves. And this is where we see Picard back at the helm, and he kicks Wesley out, and he's like, don't worry, I got
shut
this.
Up, Wesley.
And he guides the Enterprise out, and everyone's like, oh no, 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 no. But then Picard can't believe anybody doubted he was a deft pilot. He uses the gravitational force from the asteroid to slow the Enterprise, but then uses it to increase the ship's velocity and slingshot around large asteroids. And there, Data is like, oh, what a shocker. And I don't know why y'all are surprised that Picard's a deft pilot. Like, there's
he came up with the Picard maneuver after all. Come on.
Besides, they did that in the fourth movie.
I'm not there yet.
Do you think they give these captains pips to just anyone?
No, they did in the fourth TOS movie.
Yeah, when they had the whales, they had a slingshot off Earth's sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The time travel.
I mean, it should just be standard
operating procedure.
We do it now.
It should
right?
be taught at the academy, is what you're saying. Yeah. I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That and the Kobayashi Maru, which comes first. Yep.
It's a delicious Sunday.
Do you learn how to slingshot first or how to not save the crew first?
In a later episode, I'm curious to know what the class is like that you have to take to give speeches, because you have to be able to give a good speech, I think.
Oh, that's Lieutenant Steve Rogers teaches that at the
yeah. But not Lieutenant Broccoli.
No.
He's not allowed to speak.
No.
So some trivia for this episode. Susan Gibney, who played Dr. Leah Brams, auditioned for the roles of Counselor Deanna Troi and Lieutenant Tasha Yar before Marina Sirtis and Denise Crosby were cast. She was later a front runner for Captain Janeway and Seven of Nine and the Borg Queen, but Kate Mulgrew, Jeri Ryan, and Alice Krieg were all cast in those roles instead.
Yeah.
So this poor
lady.
Poor woman.
Yeah. Because we need blondes. We need more blondes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kate Mulgrew, she's not a blonde.
Oh, that's
well,
right. Yeah.
And Mulgrew was the last second replacement for Jean-Vivre Pujold. So
right.
If you ever want to see the most stilted captain in Star Trek history, try and find this.
Don't. Don't.
Yeah, there's a demo reel of Genevieve Pujold doing Star Trek lines, and she's not good.
Two other bits of trivia. Apocryphally, I guess that's the word I'm looking for here. Something that came up in Picard season 3 with Geordi's kids. In books, they had Geordi as having 3 kids, the 2 girls that we saw and a son, and their mother's name is Leah.
Oh.
And it's strongly rumored that it was Dr. Brahms that they finally got married, but it's not canon, so we don't know. And they never addressed the concept of who his wife was in Picard season 3. So we don't know. But also, I forgot what the second bit of trivia was for that.
Was it about how Brahms' music plays when they first meet? And she's curious to be named after the composer?
No, it wasn't. It was...
That character's going to show up again a little bit later.
Oh, really? Like in holodeck form or real form?
No, in real form.
Both. Both.
Both.
And actually the series finale. The last episode.
Well, we'll get there when we get there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But in the meantime, let's move on to the next episode, The Enemy. Yeah. LaForge gets left behind on a storm-plagued planet when the rest of his team encounters a Romulan warrior. This episode had me so scared. Because I was so concerned about Geordi. So responding to an unidentified distress signal from the inhospitable planet Galorndon Core, deep in Federation space, a landing party composed of Worf, Riker, and Geordi find a crashed Romulan vessel and brings in one badly wounded survivor. Geordi falls in a deep crevice, fails to beam back up with the rest of the crew, and the party only originally had a brief beam-up window due to the storm, hence Riker and Worf decided to leave without Geordi. The wounded person they find is a Romulan. He has a non-cranial brain injury and suggests that he, too, is in danger of magnetic radiation. Picard is worried that this might be a new Romulan offensive inside the Federation territory. Data intercepts a Romulan ship signal announcing it will pass the neutral zone in 6 hours to reach the planet they were on. Picard forbids it because Romulans don't enter Federation space. he calls Commander Tomalak, strangely with us to, or you're Tomalak.
Oh, no, I'm Tomalak. Yeah, totally not a Romulan spy.
Not.
Yeah. Picard,
can't you tell? Just look at him. He's not.
Picard promises he will return the wounded Romulan only after recovering Geordi from the planet. Tomalak claims that the Romulan ship had a navigation issue, and that's why it crashed on this planet. But it was a 0.5 light years off course, so this theory is not feasible. Riker and Worf are against handing over the Romulan to Tomalak. Meanwhile, back on the planet, Geordi fashions some tools using his phaser and the metal ore he finds inside the crevice and manages to climb out. This scene gave me real, I know it's not, but gave me real Homeward Bound vibes. Like, if you know the scene, you know the scene. I don't have to describe it for you guys. But it elicited the same feelings.
I love that you invoked Homeward Bound.
He had to climb out, and we weren't sure if he was going to make it.
I know.
Back on the Enterprise, Tomalak, he's assuring Picard that there is no other Romulan on the planet, and Geordi is shockingly surprised by another Romulan. So there are indeed two Romulans on the planet.
So Romulans lie? Oh.
What?
I know.
But the Romulan that he encounters is blinded by the radiation. So in the meantime, Geordi loses his sight as well to the magnetic radiation, and his visor cannot operate in the electromagnetic soup. Geordi and Bakra, the Romulan he works with, need to collaborate to survive. Wesley has improvised a neutrino beam signal and sent it to the surface via the probe. I love ingenuity aboard the Enterprise, because Wesley comes up with this plan and Picard's like, yep, that's the thing, do it. And I love how smart Tawny Newsome on the Star Trek cruise talked about how much she loves Star Trek because she calls it competency porn.
Oh, yes. Nicely put.
Yeah. So if Geordi can find the beam, he can communicate with the Enterprise. He can see the beam, but Bakra is not allowing him to go there. Meanwhile, Worf proves to be the only possible blood donor in order to save the captive that they have. But as you can believe it, Worf objects to helping the species which killed his parents. He talks to Riker, and Riker gives a fantastic speech. Again, he must have aced that course at Starfleet about giving a speech and motivational yes. talk about how he shouldn't blame all Romulans for the death of his parents. Meanwhile, Tomalak has reached the neutral zone and wants to come pick up his officer. But again, Picard refuses and says, I will come to you in the neutral zone once I get Geordi back on board. And Tomalak is not impressed that Picard won't even follow a mission of mercy. Bakra, back on the planet, is convinced that he and Geordi need to collaborate, and they start moving together towards the beam. But then Bakra gets a high fever and loses his legs. He suggests Geordi pairs his visor with a tricorder and try on the neutrino beam. This scene in particular really irked me because Geordi was so willing to give up so fast. And that's not Starfleet. That's not the Starfleet I know.
You're right.
It's
not even the Geordi from 10 minutes earlier.
It's not even the Geordi from 10 minutes earlier. Like, it just felt like I understand losing one of your critical senses of sight is really disheartening, but you're Starfleet, man.
Yeah.
You cannot give up on this. You know for a fact they're not giving up on you, so you have to try as well. But eventually he's convinced, and he pairs his visor with a tricorder, and they find the neutrino beam. And together, Bakra and Geordi reach the beam. Tomalak crosses the neutral zone, heads towards the planet. Picard orders a red alert, of course. And then Picard also, again, gives a fantastic speech begging Worf to save this Romulan's life. And Worf is just like, I'm sorry, dude. I can't do it. And I'm
you
on
talking
my
to
couch
me?
Like... I'm on my couch like, you are willing to risk a war between the Federation and the Romulans over a grudge?
They started it.
They
don't start none, won't be none.
They did start it. Worf said that he would do it if ordered, but Picard he's a bigger man and he's not going to do that. He asks and he says, I'm even begging you to do it. And Worf's like, sorry, bro. And ultimately, the Romulan dies, which gives Tomalak an excuse to start something if he feels like it.
Oh, yeah.
So once he's aware that the Romulan has died, he arms his phasers. Enterprise raises its shields. But of course, that's when Geordi and Bakura meet at the neutrino beam. And they are like, well, we can't beam them back up if our shields are up. And if we lower our shields, they're going to shoot. And so Picard does a great, hey, give me a minute. We have reason to believe that there's another Romulan down there. We're going to lower our shields. Just be cool for a minute, please. They lower the
another
shields.
Romulan, you say?
No, there's not. No.
Is this a gambit?
There's only one.
So they beam them back up on the bridge. Specifically, Picard is like, keep this on. We're going to show him that we're beaming him up. It's so transparent in everything he does, right? In order to prevent a war with the Romulans.
Officers, my hand are on the wheel. That's what this was.
They beam them back up. Tomalak's like, hey, a Romulan. And Bakura's like, hey, I hate to admit this, but this guy did save my life. We should just skedaddle. And they do it. They skedaddle. And happy ever after for this episode in particular. Originally, the Klingon that, or not the Klingon, the Romulan they brought on board was going to survive, and the writers were trying to come up with a valid reason for Worf to save his life. Michael Piller convinced them that it would be entirely in accordance with Worf's character to let him die. And after reading that, I do have to say, I kind of agree. Because of his like grudge against Romulans, but that's Klingon, right? Like, he let him die. Air quotes heroically, right?
Yeah. Now, people know how I feel about Worf at this part in The Next Generation. I'm not crazy about the character. I think he's stiff, you know. This was a perfect way to get me to care about Worf. It made him interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And I loved that he was not going to budge, but he did say, I'll do it if you order me. And I love how Riker talked to him and Picard talked to him. Please, I'm begging you. And he said, I'm not going to unless you order me.
Well, even Beverly tried.
Yeah.
He's just like, sorry, Doc.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing me an interesting Worf. Here he is.
Since the father in just a few more episodes. You get more of that.
Yeah, it's... I don't think we see it often enough where we see a character who is so unwavering in their beliefs that like they don't just cave in to advance the plot further. Like him choosing not to help that Romulan during the episode, was I incredibly frustrated? Yes. After the episode and thinking about who Worf is as a Klingon and you know his position within the Federation and his own culture, honestly, totally makes sense.
It's much more interesting for him to stick to his guns rather than, all right, I'll do it. Yeah,
totally.
It's also interesting, too, because Roddenberry has credit on this episode as a writer, and his big thing was he never wanted interpersonal conflict between crew members. And so for this episode to get by unscathed where he's literally flat out saying, nope, I'm not going to, and them responding to it. I also love that there's another pillarism in this and that they wanted to start having bad guys that stick around because Tomalak's around for more episodes. And you especially get some delicious characters when the Cardassians start becoming more of a presence that there's these gulls that stick around because you're going to be far more invested as a viewer if you're familiar with this bad guy, you know?
Yeah. That makes sense.
And I think one of the other things about this is Geordi, you know, throughout this episode, this is another, I think that this season, and Lee kind of alluded to it a little earlier, is where last season may have been like the Wesley Crusher season, you know, a little bit of growth for Wesley, especially without Beverly there. This seems to be an arc for Geordi where we're seeing Geordi grow up in different ways. He, you know, he gets the promotion to lieutenant commander. He gets the hit chief engineer's job. But we see also a very vulnerable Geordi here because he goes straight Velma as soon as he falls down that pit and loses his visor. And I'm just like, oh, it's like, Velma and Cyclops. Oh, no, I can't see. But, you know, him giving up, I don't think it was so much him losing his Starfleet training. I think it's just the utter frustration of we've done all of these things and I'm frustrated. And we can see, you can easily see it in that he's, you know, I'm stuck on this planet. I don't know what's going on. And I just got captured with my own phaser by a Romulan. So I don't think it was just giving up. I think it was everything coming to the surface for him. So yeah, he's going to kick some rocks and be upset, but he does get it into gear and it's like, okay, look, we can get out of this. When Bahra is like, look, we've got to work together. And Geordi, if you remember correctly, had started like, look, if we work together, we can go. We've got a beacon. We can go. And Bahra's like, no, I got a phaser. We're going to sit right here.
Mm-hmm. Rob, you make a really good point too, because like who among us hasn't been so frustrated we're just ready to give up, right? Like
yesterday.
Right? Like Wednesday, am I right?
Yeah.
But like, even though I put a lot of expectations on Geordi because he is Starfleet, like gotta remember he's human too. And who among us has not been so overwhelmed by the feeling of defeat that we do just want to give up?
Maybe Carrie, if I bought three pattern buffer supports instead of just one, we could have had a better beam out window and I could have gotten out of here with the guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, next time. Carrie was showing us a Romulan action figure.
I was thinking that Tomalak had his own action figure, but he apparently didn't get one.
Oh, I mean, it could be. You can do any Romulan.
I wonder because Tomalak. Andreas Katsoulis, the guy that played Tomalak, he was also like one of the primary character actors on Babylon 5. He was on almost every episode. So I don't think that there were likeness issues because I know you want your action figure to be out there and sell because you get a little money.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys see Shania Twain got her own Barbie and on TikTok? They presented her with her Barbie and she walked around the corner, shouted "Sublime!" and then walked right back around. Corner.
There's a whole series of inspirational famous women Barbies that were announced today.
And, oh, really?
And one of them, Kylie Minogue.
Oh, I mean, is she not? Is she not?
She's very inspirational
to me.
Wait, this is a perfect, this awkward feeling I'm feeling right now, perfect segue for the next episode, the price. While the Enterprise hosts negotiations for control of a stable wormhole, Troy forms a personal relationship with an opposing negotiator, unaware of his true being.
Oh, I hate this episode.
I hate
this character. Like, this guy is like 80s cheese leading man who can't make it as a leading man. And
there's a lot of reasons to hate this episode. I hate the fact that Troy was so easily taken in by this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, so easily. But also, who among us, right? Like, who among us hasn't been emotionally manipulated by a hot guy, you know?
Oh, well, yeah. It's also the episode with the notorious yoga scene or the stretching scene between Troy and...
That scene, having context now, makes it 1,000 times funnier.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. The opening scene, first of all, Deanna walking back into her quarters immediately goes to take off her uniform and bra. Like, we love a relatable queen. Like, she's just like me for real. So, but she is in her quarters. She goes to the computer. She's like, computer... She must be on her period or something. I would like a real chocolate sundae. And the computer is like, can you define real? And she's like, I don't want it to be synthesized. And the computer is like, I don't know what you want from me. I'm a computer. And she's like, God damn it. And then Picard is like, hey, Deanna, I need you to come down here. We have guests and we're about to witness a wormhole. And she's like, God forbid I miss the wormhole. And she heads down and Riker's like, can I get you anything? And she's like, hopefully there's chocolate. Anyway, and so we're introduced to this group of diplomatic negotiations While they are in stable orbit around the planet Barzan, which is badly dependent on external supplies. The Barzans have discovered a single stable wormhole perfect for travel all the way to a distant gamma quadrant. This is their first natural resource, and they plan to offer the wormhole for bidding to ensure the survival of their own planet. It takes a century of travel at warp 9 to reach the gamma quadrant, and the wormhole covers the same amount of distance in only a few seconds. The Barzan planet is inhospitable to most other life forms, hence the Enterprise has been requested to hold the bidding process. Barzan is represented by Premier Bhavani. The Federation is in a bidding contest with the Caledonian, represented by Leor. The Cresselians are represented by Divinoni Rahl. And Rahl, this guy, he's a negotiator who represents different clients of various types of negotiation situations. The wormhole occurs every 233 minutes and might be due to a radiation buildup in the accretion disks. The Ferengi, these messy bitches, the Ferengi show up and say, "Hey, we didn't know a thing was for sale. We want $5. And they just have to insert themselves in any type of bidding situation.
Of course.
Federation delegate Seth Mendoza is informed by Data that the technologically backwards Barzanian's observations are fallible and the wormhole may actually prove unstable. Data and Geordi test it themselves by sending a manned probe inside the wormhole to determine its real value. I don't know, you guys. Do we just test wormholes?
Not with people.
With the only Sung android in the universe.
Yeah. You send a probe. Yeah. You send a probe or an automated shuttle with the smart computer on it. By now they have those things, you know.
Send anybody. Send Wesley.
You know.
Yeah.
We're
going to send the only android. And the chief engineer. Listen, the two highest ranking science guys we got on the ship.
You send the M8 shuttlecraft. You know the
that's what peanut hamper's for.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what you send peanut hamper in. So Data and Geordi themselves go into the wormhole, and the Ferengi also decide to send their own probe.
We are sending our own probe to the wormhole.
Messy, messy, messy. Data finds that after going through the wormhole, they are only 70,000 light years away in the Delta Quadrant, but 200 light years away from the Gamma Quadrant where they were supposed to be. They are getting strange readings, and Geordi suggests they move out right now. Meanwhile, Goss, one of the Ferengi, uses a compound made from his own blood to induce allergic reactions in Mendoza and is taken out of the negotiations for several days. They do the old, they put like a type of substance on their palms, and when you go in for a handshake, it causes an allergic reaction, and they're like, you know, it's like a buzzer on your hand, you know, the oldest trick in the book. So while he's out of negotiation, Riker takes his place. During all of this, Deanna falls madly in love with the mysterious Rahl. And he just, he's so aggressive, like right out of the gate.
Again. Go ahead.
I have to give them just a little credit, because this episode literally felt like another Deanna Troi gets sexually assaulted episode.
Because
it happens mm-hmm. a lot on this show where they're just like, well, we don't know what to do with her. She's psychic. Let's sexually assault her. And in this, it felt like they were just like, at one point somebody said, should we?
See, and this is the thing. They're both half Betazoid, right?
Right.
So he's only a quarter Betazoid.
He's only a quarter.
Oh, sorry.
See, this is why, nerd, this is why she should have seen through his bullshit sooner, you know?
But also, I must ask, who among us has not been blinded by lust and hot guy? You know what I mean? Anybody? Just me.
I mean, I've made some bad decisions because of, but not, I don't know. Deanna's like 32. When I was in my 30s, I was working in the nickel mine.
Now, so after they sleep together a couple of times, she realizes that he has shrewdly used his empathetic abilities to read and play into his opponent's emotions, and he admits to Deanna that he is a quarter Betazoid.
Mm-hmm. Now, allow me, if you don't mind. I have the script for the exercise room scene. between Crusher and Troy. Mm-hmm. Troy rushing in. Sorry, I'm late. They start exercising. Crusher, you're unusually limber this morning.
Insane.
Troy, I'll say, Devononi Rall. Just says it right there. Just boom. Girls being girls. It's ridiculous and wonderful. I feel completely out of control. Happy, terrified, but there's nothing rational about this. Crusher, who needs rational when your toes curl up? Troy, I'm afraid I'm going to lose myself. I can't get enough of him. Is it possible to fall in love with one in one day? Crusher, I did. Troy, it was like this for you and Jack? Crusher, no, it was another fellow. I fell in love in a day. It lasted a week. But what a week. And then I met Jack, and it took months to figure it out with him. Troy, well, maybe I should slow down, catch my breath, not let this get out of control. Crusher and Troy together look at each other. No.
No.
Have fun, girl. Get yours.
Yeah.
But, like, having seen that scene now, like, knowing the context behind it makes it 1,000% funnier. Mm-hmm. Because, like... Seeing that scene in Lower Decks.
Yes.
Like, you have to assume there's a correlation.
I mean, it is a hilarious scene, but at the same time, I have to give it points for treating two women in a script as though they were just friends talking, because women talk that way. They, you know, mm-hmm. we have
locker room talk.
And that's you never see that sort of thing, at least at this point on television. You just don't. It was an innovative scene, as ridiculous as it was.
innovative. You wonder, were there any women in the writer's room? Because you get the girl talk, but yeah. I just realized it doesn't pass Bechdel. It's horribly not passing Bechdel.
Oh, yeah, it's 1,000 yards away from the Bechdel test, but yeah. Like it is so accurate, right, to a female relationship.
Yeah.
There's one female writer of the three people credited on this episode, but she's a 60s writer, 60s and 70s. Mm. Like, she did a lot of work on Emergency.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
So Rall uses his empath abilities to embed thoughts and feelings in other people who come to think and recognize those feelings as their own. For example, he makes Leor believe that the administrative requirements of the wormhole will be beyond the capabilities of the Caledonians and makes them withdraw from bidding. He then makes Leor make a deal with him and the Cresselians he represents regarding the Trillium 323 deposits on one of the planets in their sector. Eventually, Deanna is like, well, prior to this, Deanna's like, hey, I don't know that I like this. And he's like, well, you seemed to not mind it earlier. And I'm like, oh, okay. Fuck this guy. Like, this is absolute garbage human. And then there's a scene where Riker and Rall are having a boys chit chat. And
best scene ever.
And Rall tries to use his sexual encounters with Deanna to unsettle Riker, but Riker is the king of the poker face, and he remains unfazed.
Goddamn right he is.
He says he would support Rall if he can bring happiness to Deanna, and Deanna wrestles with the ethics and must decide whether to use her own. The Ferengi's Goth starts firing at the wormhole as he feels that the Barzans have not negotiated in good faith and have already made a secret deal with the Federation. Picard destroys the missiles launched at the wormhole. Rall uses this opening to negotiate the wormhole control for the Cresselians. They go to the bridge. Rall tells Goss the Cresselians have control of the wormhole and give the Ferengi free access in exchange for convoy privileges. Deanna reveals to the bridge that Rall and the Ferengi staged this drama to engage the Enterprise in battle and to play on the peaceful nature of the Barzans to get them to sign up with the Cresselians. Now Data and Geordi come back and report that the other end of the wormhole is unstable and shifts positions periodically, and therefore it is worthless. And end of episode, you know?
Although those two Ferengi do have another episode, the ones that end up on the other side of the wormhole. You have to wait for, I think it's second season of Voyager, but...
You'll get there.
Yeah.
So this Devononi, he's... And what's wild about him is that even though this whole debacle, you know, with the wormhole not being stable, he's just Republican enough that he counts it as a win.
I got paid, you know?
You know?
He did describe himself as a hired gun, so I'm sure no matter what, he got paid and got his. Yep. He, not only did he get paid, but he got to sleep with the hottest woman on the Enterprise. Like, wins all around. Mm. This episode featured what would become major plot points for two other series in the Star Trek universe. Star Trek Deep Space Nine, a wormhole was discovered. And then Star Trek Voyager, a ship became lost in the Delta Quadrant. Also, this is... If you remember the workout scene... Immediately after that, it cuts to 10 forward, and we see Goss talking to a Starfleet, a Starfleet crewman. And the way he's talking, he holds his hands out as if to indicate a measure of distance and says something along the lines of, it ain't bad. According to Star Trek The Next Generation Companion, Goss is referring to the size of his sex organ when he is making a revealing gesture to a Starfleet crewman in 10 forward. So go back, watch the scene that immediately follows the workout scene, and you'll see him at a bar talking to a crewman, and he's talking about the size of his Ferengi, you know?
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. Yucky! Just a yucky episode. So,
now, to be one thing that I liked about this episode was when at the final confrontation, sorry, the penultimate confrontation between Rahl and Troy, when he calls her out, like, you do the exact same thing for your captain, don't you? And you don't tell everybody on the view screen that you're a Betazoid, do you? And she's like, the frustration on her face, like, damn it, he's right. But, you know, she's like, it's different. And he's, you know, she's trying to justify how she uses her abilities.
Well, but it's like using your powers for good instead of evil, kind of a situation.
No, agreed, totally agreed. Yeah, and he is the perfect epitome of, like, he is the anti-Troy in every aspect.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. That's why I think he's a Republican.
Well, and that's why too, because like we haven't seen Betazoid males, have we? Have we been introduced to male Betazoids yet? So, and I'm wondering if because he's only a quarter Betazoid and mostly human, are his human, yucky, manipulative tendencies using the Betazoid part of him to get ahead?
I would not be a damn bit surprised. I bet you're right.
Right? Gross. Mm-hmm. Men do better.
Yes.
Which, again, great segue for the next episode, the Vengeance Factor. The Enterprise pursues a race of gatherers who continue to raid Federation outposts, unaware of the dangers lurking among them. I didn't like this episode. I thought it was so boring. And what, we couldn't get Kurt Russell? Because we see all of these guys in these, like, dystopian-type, like, Escape from New York Raiders outfits. Yeah. With fantastic hair, though, I got to admit.
Yeah.
So the Enterprise finds a ransacked ship with two heavily injured scientists. A piece of metal shard has some blood on it. Upon analysis, is found to be Akamarian. Picard knows that a race of Akamarians called Gatherers are marauders, but they've never ventured so far outside their base, and he takes the Enterprise to their system. The Enterprise is transporting the Sovereign Maruk of the Akamarians in an attempt to get a breakaway group of her people, called the Gatherers, to return to the fold, so to speak. A cluster is suspected in the Hiromi cluster. They broke away almost 100 years ago and are now known as the Gatherers, a band of scavengers forever raiding and scavenging anything they can get their hands on. Their last attempt at amnesty was about 18 years ago. 100 years ago, the Akamarians were a savage and violent race. Clans battled clans and feuds lasted for generations. Blah, 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 blah. These guys kind of suck, okay? Maruk is prepared to offer them an amnesty, but there's a great deal of mistrust between them. The Gatherers are led by Brol. Maruk says that the clan wars are over, which is why the Gatherers had to leave, but now it is the time for them to come back and reintegrate within their society. Maruk tells Picard how the clan wars went from generation to generation. Loyalty to the clan was absolute, and a small injury to any other clan member had to be answered in kind. With each confrontation, the violence grew. Meanwhile, Riker has taken an interest in Maruk's cook, Utah. Listen. Mm? Is it kind of pervy? Yes.
Yes.
Food is the language of love and expression.
It's not so bad.
It's not so bad. But so he asks her to, you know, whip up, you know, some of their food. And she's like, well, I, you know, I don't, we'd have to, is a whole thing. And so I'd love it if you could whip some up. And Riker's, who, again, down for anything. I love a culinary adventurous Riker. He's like, I want to try your food, please. And also, I would like to try some of that Utah, if you know what I mean. And she is like, but also, can we be mad? Because she is like, prepared to approach it as a servant because that's all she knows. But he is like, no, we are equals, even in lovemaking. And she's like, oh, I don't, that's unusual, right? Yeah, I don't understand it.
It all felt super creepy to me.
It was really super creepy. But also at the same time, I kind of have to give credit where it's due, where he's like, no, we are equals in everything we do.
He tried.
I
only like this. I only like this episode for one reason. Anytime anybody gives Nancy Parsons work, I'm happy.
Okay,
because all right. Carrie, you know Nancy Parsons. She was Mrs. Smith in Motel Hell. She's Farmer Vincent's wife.
Farmer Vincent's wife in Motel Hell.
Because it takes all kinds of critters to make Farmer Vincent's fritters.
I want Spooky Time Club to watch that one someday.
Yeah.
Me too.
So while Riker is trying to make it happen with Utah, the attention of the crew is diverted to finding a saboteur when one of the gatherers is killed. Utah identifies herself as the clan Terelesta to one of the gatherers and touches one particular gatherer, Volnath, which leads to his death while the negotiations are still going on. Brule wants a settlement and promises to take Marouk's offer to his leader, but then Brule's men find Volnath's dead body. Beverly confirms that he died of a heart attack, but says he had a strong heart and no arterial blockages, and that the virus that, like, killed him was specifically designed to kill one person, but highly unusual because it seems to be naturally occurring. So, kind of interesting.
And this is where the Star Trek CSI episode begins.
Yeah! So, Brule agrees to travel on board the Enterprise to meet Chorgan. Utah admits to Riker that she is a servant to Marouk and can never have freedom. And as a servant, she can leave anytime she wants, but is bound to Marouk due to a sense of duty that she cannot explain to Riker. She ends up having sex with Riker. Riker treats her as an equal and not a servant. Meanwhile, Beverly figures that Volnack had a microvirus in his blood, which caused the heart attack. And they determine he was murdered.
Murder.
The Enterprise reaches Chorgan's ship. Chorgan thinks Brule has betrayed him. Marouk tells Chorgan that she offers amnesty to all gatherers and land on Akamar for them to start a new life. Chorgan wants autonomy. Riker and Beverly figure out from the Akamar records that Volnath was from the Lornet clan, and one more member of the same clan died from the same microvirus.
And how do they figure out that it's her? Pictures. Computer. Enhance. CSI.
Data figures out that Utah was the common factor between the two deaths of the Lornet clan. And Utah, she has her own little speech about how she's like, you know, I am the last of my kind, but my kind will outlive yours. It's very metal. I kind of liked it. Riker goes on board Chorgan's ship just as Utah was about to touch Chorgan and kills her with a phaser. Utah had survived that day 100 years ago when her clan was massacred and her cells were altered to prolong her aging process so she could kill the remaining Lornex. Riker takes some shore leave to grieve for Utah.
Well, he was just grieving because he was with such an older woman. That was the problem that he had. Oh, hundreds of years?
I can't wash these old cooties off.
Some trivia for this episode. The Federation science outpost attacked by the Gatherers just prior to the episode used a large scenic background painting originally from Forbidden Planet. Oh. The painting is a planetscape seen through the window of the station.
Well, now I got to go back and look because Forbidden Planet's one of those classics, you know?
And this episode marks the reported meeting of Marina Sirtis and her future husband, Michael Lamper. He is not included in the credits as he was only an extra.
Oh, really?
Isn't that nice? The last episode of this group that we will be talking about today, The Defector. When a Romulan officer defects to the Federation with a warning of impending invasion, Captain Picard struggles to decide if he is to be believed. This episode opens with a play, and I love it when Star Trek does Shakespeare and lets you know, Patrick Stewart have a little fun. So Picard is essentially directing a Shakespearean scene because he's trying to get Data to understand the human condition, and who better to study the human condition through than Shakespeare. And I have to wonder, did they just let Patrick Stewart like riff and just have a little fun with it?
Oh, I'm sure he has all of that stuff committed to memory, you know.
He's even one of the players that's acting alongside. I was hoping the other one would be Jonathan Frakes, but alas, it's okay.
What?
Anyway, they wrap that up, and but they are informed of a craft entering the neutral zone, and it's identified as a Romulan scout, which claims to need urgent asylum from a persecutor. A Romulan warbird that pursues the scout ship through the neutral zone. The Enterprise extends the shields around the scout ship once it is in Federation territory, and the Romulan ship withdraws back into Romulan space. The wounded Cetal gets the asylum and claims to be a low-ranking logistics officer and warns that the Romulans have nearly finished building a base on the planet in the neutral zone. It is the Nelvana 3, but the Federation sensor is monitoring the neutral zone, shows no such activity. This was a fun scene when they are talking to him and he's explaining, you know, what's happening. And Riker's like, so you're telling me that there's stuff being built and the Federation just happened to not pick it up? And he's like, yeah, looks like. Pointing out flaws in your Federation technology, you idiots. Let's see. But this could possibly mean a full war. Cetal claims that the Romulans want to avenge their loss in the last war and claim the entire neutral zone. Cetal wants the Enterprise to make a surprise attack on the base and remove the threat completely. Data says that in the long story of Romulans, they have never attacked first. They prefer to test the resolve of their enemies and attack later. Cetal sets the auto-destruct on his own scout ship and prevents the Enterprise officers from examining its secrets. He says he is trying to prevent a war, but is not a traitor to the Romulans. Cetal knows of the encounter Enterprise had with two Romulan officers a couple of episodes ago. The Enterprise sensors show no activity in the Nelvana system. The Admiralty refuses the Empire's demand to return the defector and orders Picard to find out if the threat is real. Geordi analyzes the chase of the Romulan warship to the scout. By the way, that chase scene initially earlier on in the episode where we see the Romulan scout ship being chased by the warbird, that was kind of fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing them go so fast.
Oh, yeah.
They got to show off those brand new models.
He finds that three occasions the warbird had the chance to overtake the scout ship and kill it, but each time they reduced speed and kept their distance. Commander Riker and Counselor Troi are charged with questioning him further in case it's a ploy to lure them into the zone as a war pretext. Technological means came to contradictory conclusions. A probe launched by the Enterprise reveals subspace radioactivity and ionization of space, which could have resulted from cloaking of Romulan warships. But there is nothing on the planet's surface, and it is possible that the base is cloaked. But still, there's no way to be sure until the Enterprise goes and looks for itself. Cetal discloses his real identity as Admiral Jarak. This is after Data takes him to the holodeck for a rendition of his home planet Romulus, and since Cetal said that he was feeling homesick. Due to his betrayal, he can never return home. The Admiralty considers Jarak an unreliable source of information, as he is a ruthless operator. Picard demands irrefutable proof of Jarak's allegations. Picard says that Jarak is not a man of peace, so his motivation for defecting is still questionable. Jarak still argues that he tried to persuade Romulan High Command against another war with the Federation. He was shunned to a meaningless post for this reason. He wants to see his daughter grow up and hence doesn't want the war. Picard still wants proof. There's a good scene here where Jarak is like, Picard, you don't have kids, do you? And Picard's like, oh, no. And Jarak is like, well, I have a daughter and I'll never get to see her grow up. And she's going to grow up thinking that I'm an asshole. And I hate that. And I don't like it when I get lectured about why I should have kids.
Okay. Can I take the counterpoint on this one?
Yes.
Okay. Now, not wishing anyone to have kids that don't want them. From the parents' point of view, it's like one of those things where you always want to have that view of, I want my kids to have more, do better, et cetera. That, you know, when this episode aired 30 something years ago, totally didn't have, it was like, okay, that's great, whatever. But now as a father, it's kind of like, oh, no, okay, I can see the point.
I can see it.
It's a total paradigm shift.
I can definitely see I can see his perspective, right? Because like, while I don't have kids myself, I can understand, you know, as a parent, your whole life revolves around your kids. And he obviously cares a lot about his daughter and wants to not be a defector in her eyes, right? And wants to be someone that she can look up to, and he's not getting that opportunity. I can totally understand his perspective on it. I still don't like lectures.
I will never let you... Other than about my kids coming to play with your cats.
Duroc divulges the locations and plans of the Romulan fleet and also gives engine details for the cloaking systems and all their warbirds. Enterprise enters the neutral zone and heads for Nelvana 3. On Nelvana 3, Enterprise finds no indication of any base, and Picard concludes that Romulans knew of Duroc's dissatisfaction and were feeding him false information to test his loyalty. Oh, what a bummer for that guy. The Enterprise prepares to leave. Two Romulan warbirds decloak and intercept. Captain Tomalak is back, and he wants to avenge the humiliation from two episodes ago, and he wants to dissect the Enterprise and display it as a prize at Romulan capital. Who could blame him?
It's Tomalak broken demands... a hole on display for all to see.
Tomalak demands the return of Duroc as a traitor and surrender of Enterprise as prisoners of war. Picard plays his card and decloaks the Klingon warships that accompanied him to the neutral zone. Tomalak is forced to withdraw. Duroc commits suicide. End of episode.
Thank you, Fade Ronald Moore.
Yeah, that's Ronald Moore. The part I liked about this whole thing was the whole... Is he, in fact, a traitor, or is he pretending? And I like that. And I really liked the twist in that, yes, he was a traitor, but he was being set up to be the traitor. The Romulans
sucks.
Were, the Romulans were feeding him the information, allowing him to do all of this.
And the standoff between Picard and Tomalak at the end is just like, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm. It is.
The mutually assured destruction bit is just fantastic. And... nice to see the Klingon show up to help out.
Yeah, that was nice.
Ronald D. Moore describes the story as the Cuban Missile Crisis at the Neutral Zone.
I like that.
I didn't see any X-Men there. Oh, wait. Different movie. Sorry. Different franchise.
But like Lee mentioned earlier, this episode introduced three new studio models to the series. The new 4-foot miniature of the Enterprise D, the Romulan scout ship, and the second Diderdex class model.
Direct. Yeah.
All three can be seen during the standoff scene during the first act. The original large-scale model of the Enterprise D created for the pilot was 6 feet long. Its size made it difficult to work with, and it was decided to create a new 4-foot model, which appears for the first time in this episode. The new model had greater surface detail and was much easier to work with. There were a number of subtle changes to the ship, including the addition of a row of windows on the leading edge of the saucer to match the location of 10 forward, which earlier in the episode, they say this 10 forward has the best views, which love to see it
right there.
The defector also inspired a specific game mode in Star Trek The Next Generation, Pinball Machine. In the Romulan game mode, the Enterprise encounters three Romulan warbirds decloaking in the neutral zone. If the player makes the correct shots, two Klingon birds of prey decloak to block two of the Romulan ships. So if anybody can track down that pinball machine, love to see it. I would love to.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a YouTube video of it somewhere.
I love pinball.
But that's this week's episodes. What do we think? Best episodes ever?
Pretty good.
Getting there.
I think the defector's a really solid episode. Like very, very solid writing.
I was getting a little annoyed that the Romulans made an appearance again so soon.
Yeah.
But this was a really well done episode. I thought there was, you know, just enough tension, enough, you know, what is it all? Is it what's real? What's not real? Who's telling the truth? Who's lying? Real Cold War stuff. I thought it was really fascinating.
Yeah.
The last episode also is going to come kind of into play in season 5 and 6 or 6 and 7. I can't remember which, with the political intrigue that we saw with, Tomalak, the traitor.
The
Romulan spy, yeah. And what happens with Romulus and with where they're going. So this pays off a lot later.
Yeah.
This is also the last episode to air in the 80s. The next episodes from here on out are all in the 90s.
Are all 90s. Nice. Okay.
Next week we have what has been argued by many, many, many people as one of the best episodes of Trek, period.
Including this guy right here.
Yeah.
Lee
completely
will not
agree.
Stop talking about Yesterday's Enterprise.
Well, it's the first time. I mean, I watched the show every week. And by the second season, I had a group of friends that we got together. We did a potluck dinner. We all brought food. We had a big party. We'd sit down. We'd eat dinner. We'd watch Next Gen. And it was a party. And this was the first time that 3 minutes in, we all just shut up.
There was no talking.
There was no back and forth. It was eyes on screen. In some cases going, what the hell? And then we talked about the episode afterwards because
And it's one of my favorite ships.
Yeah.
So next week next episode we will be talking about these episodes, The Hunted, The High Ground, Deja Q, which I'm very excited about.
A Matter of Perspective
and Yesterday's Enterprise. So you'll have to forgive us if we kind of rush through the other episodes to talk about Yesterday's Enterprise.
We'll be spending some time on Yesterday's Enterprise. Sorry,
I know you
folks,
guys are excited.
I think a little time on Deja Q is warranted too. It's a fun episode. So.
My plan is, I haven't watched these episodes yet. Rush through the other three episodes that aren't Deja Q and Yesterday's Enterprise.
Yeah,
because like, I love a Q episode.
Matter of Perspective is just. It's not bad, but it feels like a filler show, you know, like they knew it was coming. So,
Well, that's what we'll talk about next time. And until then, we will keep going where no man has gone before, but a lot of people have gone before. Thanks, everybody.